So, welcome back everyone to Virtual Machines. And yesterday we continued with our translation of Prolog or Prol to finish the translation of predicates and predicate definitions. We talked about the need for introducing facilities for backtracking in order to be able to handle the non-deterministic branching between the different definitions of predicates. And therefore, a lot of new infrastructure was introduced, particularly the trailing space, so where you could store your variable values. So this was that particular part. Then we introduced a bunch of new registers that had to go into the stack frame for representing each of these predicates stack frames. Then we talked about how backtracking would work, reverting to the respective values from the stack frame where the backtracking pointer would point to, whereas we would reset the bindings that we had introduced to particular references via the log that we have kept in the trail space. And yeah, this was the resetting part. And then we talked about the actual setting and removing of the breakpoints, backtracking points with the set backtracking point and delete backtracking point. Remember that we have these backtracking points throughout the almost all of the specified clauses except for the last one, because as soon as you start evaluating the last clause for a particular predicate, then you have run out of alternatives to branch to, so you don't need any backtracking on this level anymore. And if something fails binding in this last clause, then you have to backtrack even one level higher to whatever evaluation has triggered that particular predicate. So this is why the backtracking is just done locally throughout the first 1 to F minus 1 clauses. Then this is the semantics for this try and backtracking and so on. So this is the point where we stand right now. We have introduced these backtracking points, and we have these try instructions that piece by piece iterate through all the alternatives that there are in case that you backtrack at one point. So what happens now if I run through a particular clause? And for that, we have the body of the translation scheme for clauses like this, where we first of all, of course, have allocated stack space with a pushenv, and then we focus on all the goals codes with code G of G1 to GN, and finish it up with a popenv. And usually this popenv is a thing that, well, if we go back to the languages from before, this is usually the place where you would clean up your stack from everything that you have needed for performing your current computations and make space for new computations afterwards. Typically, during runtime, the stack grows with each call to a procedure, in our case a predicate, and is at some point shrinking back again in the case of our standard languages, it shrinks as soon as we leave the current function body through usual return. However, in our case, it might have been that the execution or the evaluation of one of the goals over here, for example, may have triggered another predicate call, and this predicate call has succeeded for now, for example, but might have established a new backtracking point. If everything goes through for that particular predicate call, this goal returns and is continued with further goals, and if all of them also go through, then we will at some point reach the popenv, of course. But the thing is, this is also called from, or potentially is called from, some outside predicate, which might continue computation and run into a point where there's where it realizes that unification would fail. And in that case, you would have to backtrack to the last backtracking position, which might have been opened in here as the last backtracking point. And in that case, what would have to work is you would have to go back to this configuration, meaning you would have to go back to a point in time which you have, which in ordinary languages you would have popped from the stack long ago. But due to this mechanism of doing backtracking, there might still be the backtracking pointer pointing to the old, already somehow discarded stack frame. This is a bad thing. This shouldn't happen. So, in order for this system to still be able to do backtracking without overwriting every stack frame that still could be reached via the backtracking pointer, what is usually done is this cleanup on the stack at the end of the evaluation of a predicate is usually only done when the system is sure that there's no way to find your way back into some child frame via the backtracking pointer. You can usually check something like that. There is quite an easy to implement check for that by just comparing the backtracking pointer to the current frame pointer. In case that the backtracking pointer is pointing to somewhere above your current frame pointer, then there is still a child that has kept a backtracking point alive. And if that is the case, you should probably not remove your current stack frame, even though you're leaving your function, but instead just keep it as it is and let the system continue to compute. And this will just create situations where you will, instead of removing all of the old stack frames, you will still keep them on there and just keep building on and on and on, although in between you will have already left a few functions for some time. The only situation in which you are actually allowed to remove those things is, of course, when for example, you have done a few backtracking instances already and have run out of options in your child predicate that you have called from there. And if there's no other option left, usually the child removes its backtracking pointer, so that in the end, when you then go in the phase of removing these frames, you can then realize that the last active backtracking pointer is beyond your frame, and you can remove. Yes. You mean via these backtracking pointers, or? You mean underneath? You should not. Well, you need to have them whenever you do the backtracking at some point. You still need to have the values untouched there in case that you return to the former state and do some different decision. But still, like the parameters of the frame that was opened there still need to be present. With this special purpose popenv that we will implement here, that won't do away with the frames, then usually there's no other way of removing anything from the stack in that sense. And our frame pointer, the stack pointer still points to the highest position in the stack, and every new thing that you allocate will still be above whatever has come in principle before that, and thus you will never run into the content that you still need to keep on there. So this is the idea, that you just put above and above and above. So if you could somehow make sure that you will never again access anything like that, then you will probably be fine. There's a concept for that that is called trimming, for example. So if you progress on through the evaluation of your goals, for example, you can at some point remove a few of the local variables. Yes. But the trick is to arrange it that way that the locals that will soon run out of usage will be on top, so that you can still remove from the top. But yeah, we'll come to that at some point. I guess you could probably, if you think hard enough, maybe you can come up with an optimization that would do away with a little bit of what comes in between. But usually you would assume that everything that is down there is still somehow reachable through the usual walk through the stack hierarchy. So yeah, well, I think this is quite a good spot to see what actually really happens during evaluation of these programs. So as long as there's alternative choices, you keep building on top of the stack, and this is quite scary to see how far the stack can grow if you never ever pop anything from there, except for when you run out of options. Yeah. So, anyway, what the condition is to be able to tell whether you're allowed to pop or not is, well, of course, if you are either the last or only clause, then, well, there's no other option anymore, so you don't need to keep the stack frame anymore. And the other thing is if there is any backtracking point in your history open that still has options to fulfill, then you also don't remove the stack frame for now. At some point later on, when you return to the backtracking point and evaluate further and further on, at some point you will drop this backtracking point anyway, and then the popenv will remove the stack frame. So, the popenv then, what does it do? It in case that the guard here that determines whether there are backtracking points still active, if this, or well, if they are not if there are none active, if that fires, then you can remove the frame pointer. And what is happening in any way is that there's the execution continues with the positive continuation, and the frame pointer is restored to whatever was the last frame pointer. So this is the kind of the way that we are used to removing the stack frame. Then there's the case where the there's still an open backtracking point, so this one doesn't fire. This one only restores program counter and frame pointer, but the frame is still kept on there, and computation is carried out wherever the stack pointer actually still points to. So, yeah, we keep the content of the stack alive in this situation. Okay, so now, with having all the facilities up and running for implementing unification, predicate calls, selection of different clause implementations for certain predicates, and keeping backtracking alive, we can now go on and do the last step for a complete program, which means that we have now queries and the predicate implementations that the query is referring to. So, program looks like the following. We usually have a collection of predicates, and we have one goal here as the query to execute. And yeah, so in on that level, we are interested in whether the system will accept this goal as something which is compatible with the predicates. And if it is not, we need to at some point inform the programmer of that it is not not a valid query, so we need an instruction for failure to communicate that, and this is the no instruction. And intuitively, you would place it at some point which is reachable through a whole chain of negative continuations, and the last negative continuation, where there's no other point where to where you could recover from, you would then link to this no instruction. Then there would be code that initiates the actual evaluation for the literal G, which is our query, and the code for the actual definitions of each of the predicates, and with that you are then usually done. So how to organize that? You would probably prepare a little bit by giving initial values to the registers and allocating free space for the globals, being the free variables of a goal from the query. And then when the query evaluation goes through, what you would do is, well, either you reach the no instruction for failure, and if not, then you would have to somehow return the bindings that have been determined for these global variables as side effects during the evaluation of the query goal. And, well, let's have a look at how code for such a program looks like. So we said we would have to prepare the machine accordingly, so we would start by initializing the registers in a meaningful way, as well as well, providing a way for the machine to say no, this query has not been valid together with our predicates, and in order to establish this chain of negative continuations at some point reaching this no thing is stored at a particular address that we give into the initialize routine for to enter at the negative continuation frame chain at some point. Then there's push env for establishing enough room for the globals of the goal. Then there's a goal itself, which needs to be evaluated. And after the goal is evaluated and everything went wrong, with at some point reaching the positive continuation of that goal thingy, then we would probably continue with the halt D, which would then just print out all the bindings that would have been introduced for the D many globals, if there is any bindings for any of them. And yeah, then the only thing that still needs to be there is, well, during the code generation for the query goal, we can jump to some label of any predicate, and we need to generate code for that. So this is why there's the code P for all the predicates then. The globals are considered to be the free variables of G, and they get fixed addressing scheme like that. Halt D, we have talked about, this terminates the program while giving you the binding of the globals. And well, usually in these prolog systems, you can kind of continue outputting examples starting from the last positive example that has been given to you, which is in that sense just another backtracking call. You issue just another backtracking case where you backtrack the last decision and let the system figure out whether there is another succeeding binding for the globals such that the query is still valid. So this would just consist in another backtracking call and the system would continue running. So this is what usually happens for these prolog programs. Now we need to talk about how this init is actually looking like. So, the init would start by setting the stack into an initial kind of frame. And these are the six cells for that have, for example, this negative continuation set to whatever is given as parameter to init. And remember, this is usually the parameter that we fill with the address where we have placed our no instruction. So the mother of all frames in that sense is just containing as negative continuation address the pointer to no for whenever everything fails and there's no valid binding that will fulfill the combination of the goal with the predicates. So apart from that, then there's some kind of initial values for the heap pointer, the trailing pointer, and the current backtracking pointer points, of course, to what this first mother of all frames actually is pointing to. So both of those go to the first frame on the stack itself. So, in an example, and the examples go get larger and larger in this now. Yeah, so what is there? There is this init as the establishing the first frame of all with the negative continuation at n, which should contain a no and
excuse me.
Indeed it does. So you find that no is there. And then what is done is that there is the goal from the query, which is just a predicate without any parameters, so there is no globals in that sense, which will boil down into a push env of zero. We will build up a first predicate frame for that with a mark A and continue afterwards with just halting the machine, giving back success if the everything goes to plan. And well, in between, what we will do is we will actually really perform a call to the predicate zero, predicate P of arity zero, and it turns out that well, this is this predicate here, and you might note that this has only one clause that defines this, so this is one that doesn't have any backtracking by itself, so we can kind of straightforwardly do this implementation. Oh well, I think it is this is not everything that happens here, but let's just for now start over here. So there is one local variable in there, which is this x thingy, so we start with a push env of 1, and then we prepare for the first goal, which is a call to a predicate q of arity 1 with the first variable as a parameter, so we put the variable still unbound on the push down and call the thing and continue afterwards with whatever is found at B. So this is the first part, evaluating this this predicate call and continuing with, well, another predicate call for T again of X. This time X is usually bound or considered to be bound, so this is a put ref here instead of a put var. We call the predicate T and continue at C after we have, of course, set up a frame for the whole thing, and this then terminates this particular predicate implementation with popping the frame for that thing, at least possibly. So this is that. Then the Q implementation, maybe, because this is the first one that's going to be called in there. Q turns out being this predicate that has only one clause again. Fine, that's always the nice ones. You find it over here, where there's one actual parameter, so this is the variable that we're gonna keep on the stack. We will have a continuation at D after evaluating the predicate call to S, which is this one here, and we also need to put the reference to the parameter on there with put ref, and then we can possibly pop the stack frame. So that's that. The more interesting one is probably the one from here, the S one, which is called in there, which consists of two clauses now. So what to do about two clauses? Well, this opens up, of course, with the label for this predicate. But having two clauses now, we have to to take care of backtracking. Backtracking is done with a set of the backtracking pointer before and after all the clauses except for the last. Since we have two clauses here, it's just around the first one. So we have a set backtracking pointer together with a delete backtracking pointer, and in between we take care of the first clause implementation under E, and only then we will continue with whatever comes as next thing with jump to F. The E thing then is the first of these clauses that has one parameter, so push env1. There will be a call of a predicate T1, so we do a mark with a continuation, put the parameter, now bound one with a dash above on there, and then in the end do pop env for this one. Okay, and yeah, this is the first clause. The second clause is the one that we store under F, so we go from here to there. F does also have a parameter, so we do push env1 to store that. We put reference 1 on there, unify with atom A, and then remove stack frame possibly. So this is the blue predicate, and the only one that is missing now is the yellow one, this one here, which is just what is left over there. T with one parameter, reserving space of one, putting the reference on top of the push down, unifying with B, and then removing the stack frame again. So that's that. So with that, we can somehow already start executing PROL programs. We have everything that we need to have by now. The remaining thing now is to come up with optimizations for what we have done so far, same as we have done for the functional programming. So similar to what we've done before, there's also this concept of trying to reuse frames in order to save upon creation of new frames, and with this picture in mind that you build frame upon frame upon frame upon frame on the problem machine, then yeah, you can imagine that this is quite a desirable trait of a Prolog program. So let's have a look into that. So the idea would be that for predicates, if in a clause you find that the last goal is again a recursive call, well, this is then probably a good opportunity to maybe just reuse the frame that we have already opened so far. So yeah, first of all, of course, we can only do that for the last goal of a clause that we then call a last call. And yeah, this one we will try to evaluate in the current stack frame. And yeah, in case that this is then complete at some point, we can save the step of returning to our current frame, because this is now reused, and can just overtake the continuation of this one as the continuation of our recursive call, and just jump directly outside of this thing. So this will take away a lot of frames, possibly at least. So in order to do so, we might revisit our code generation scheme for clauses. And yeah, this and maybe highlight how the actual last goal, if it is a recursive call, would look like, particularly with respect to what code is actually really generated and what instructions are involved in there. So let's have a look at the clause code for this fellow over here. So it boils down to that part with G1 to GN minus 1 being the goals here, except for the last goal, which in case that we have a last call would consist in this part. Now inlined and not written as goal code of GN. And yeah, so we see what happens there is that within this mark B and call QH, we usually have this concept of creating a new frame and doing the call, and in the end then of course also the possible pop end for removing the frame again. And yeah, so the idea would be, in order to circumvent building up a new frame, instead of doing that in every case, we will introduce a new instruction last mark and an instruction last call that will take care of not explicitly creating a new stack frame, but instead reuse the current one. So this is the transformation that is done. Now you see that for the whole code generation, we have replaced the things in question by a last mark and a last call. So what's the matter with those two now? Again, of course, we will have to consider the problem of possibly still open backtracking points. If there are still backtracking points, we might consider to return to our current stack frame. Thus, it would be probably better not to fuss around with the current stack frame by reusing it, but instead it's probably still better to actually really introduce a new stack frame. So that is why this last mark thing is still doing this check on whether there is a backtracking point that is up higher in the address space as the frame pointer currently is. And thus this last mark then first of all does this check, and in case that we decide, well, we might still need our stack frame, then we will construct a new one for the recursive call. And in case that there is no backtracking to take care of, well, last mark just doesn't do anything, but instead aims for reusing the current stack frame. Same principle is somewhat behind the last call. Depending on whether there is backtracking to take care of or not, the last call will behave like the former just ordinary call. This is when there is backtracking to be taken care of, then of course the call has to use the new stack frame. And in every other case, well, then we can just reuse the current one. So this is again doing its usual check and referring to the former implementation whenever there is backtracking to take care of. In every other case, we can then just move our currently newly provided bindings for the parameters down into the parameter space by moving them from the top of the stack into the parameter space within the frame. This is what we do with the move MH, and then just jump back to the beginning of the code for the current function, which just get given here and be done with that, and thus start reiterating on the same code again in like a loop fashion, which is what we usually want to do with these last calls. So the last call then you see working like this, where you then everything that you need to do is you need to transport the newly computed actual parameters down to the space in the locals where they actually belong now. And since this is the case where there's no backtracking in between, we can overwrite the former parameters with the new actual ones and continue jumping to the start of the function by setting the program counter accordingly. So as an example, here we have such a thing where the clause looks like clause for predicate A is having as last goal a call, particularly a recursive call. So this is exactly the case where we can apply our optimization. So usually we do our push of the local variables. What are local variables here? It's of course x and y being the parameters. And is there any local variable? Turns out yes, there is for this x1. So this is third local, altogether gives us three locals. Push enter of three makes sense there. Then the first goal to execute is the call to f, which we have to prepare by marking, thus creating a stack frame with the continuation after the call has been done. And what is given there is the put ref and put var for x. X bar and x1, and then we're done with this thing. Now we have to do the recursive call, which is now done with last mark instead of mark, and last call. Apart from that, that's just a put ref for both of the parameter variables. So that is that. If we think a little bit more about that, we can even optimize it more in case that the last call is actually really if the clause is actually the last, or and the last literal is the only one there, we can just skip this possible generation of a stack frame and just immediately rewrite our parameters and do the jump back to the beginning. And this would, for example, apply to the this very, very early motivating example of this predicate for appending lists. Oh well. So this one has just one predicate call there, and this is the only call in there, and it's recursive. So well, we can now even get rid of the last call for doing that, and instead we'll just directly at E start with putting the refs on there, and then just continuing by moving the parameters down to the space in the stack frame where they belong, and then jump back to the start of the app3 thing, which would then restart the whole execution of that thing. So, yeah, that is for that. Then another optimization would be, well, trying to, since stack frames are things that we find a lot in there, we would probably like to diminish their size as far as possible. And one idea of that is to keep track of alive and dead variables. And this is a concept that keeps track of whether a variable is still referred to or used in the program, and as soon as it ceases to be used, it's considered to be dead and doesn't need to be kept around anymore. An example for that would be a chain of predicates like this one, where if you look closer, it has a particular structure of just going from predicate to predicate and carrying over certain bindings with just one variable per pair of predicates. So, for example, you would have the local variable x1 carrying over bindings to p2, x2 carrying over bindings from p2 to p3, and x3 carrying over bindings over there, and there's just the variables x and z are the ones that are taken from the parameters, which will in that sense, yeah, for this z thing, this will be alive to the very end. But of course, the lifetime of x1 will expire as soon as the evaluation of p2 is done, same as the lifetime of x2 is done as soon as p3 is evaluated. So, yeah, this is the two dead variables that are introduced there. And the idea would be to for dead variables to remove them out of the local variables, and therefore we introduce a particular instruction that would be there for removing the space for these locals from the stack via this trim thing. So trim thing would reset the stack pointer to point to the given offset based on the frame pointer. And yeah, so the dead locals, of course, you have to make sure that they are not reachable via tricks like backtracking to a former point in our execution or evaluation. So if there is a backtrack point that has been established earlier, you might still want to you might still want to have the correct values stored on the stack and should not overwrite them. So we have to take care of that, and this is usually done with the check here whether you have introduced new backtracking points or not. So otherwise, trim just doesn't do anything. So this is a simple thing that you can do as long as you arrange the layout of your address environment such that it fits the lifetime of your variables. And this would, for example, be the case over here, where the variable x1, which runs out of liveness at first, already after the evaluation of p2, goes to the very end of your address environment, thus at the very top of the stack part for your locals, and thus can be trimmed away quite early on. And the second one that runs out of liveness will be this X2, which runs out of liveness at P3, and this goes to one place before the X1, so this can be trimmed away at the next possible time. So after the evaluation of each of these goals, you possibly find that there is a trim used. So we have, let's maybe mark or highlight the places P1 is found there. So at P1 nothing runs out of liveness, so there is no trim there. At P2, which is here, after P2 is evaluated, then X1 will run out of liveness, so there is a trim there, which will trim away the last local variable. And then there's P3, which is found there, so here again there is a spot where we can trim down the locals by one, by just removing the X2, and then there's just the last call, which, well, doesn't do anything, and yeah, that's that. So, I think this might already be the final optimization that is out there, but let's see, and let me be surprised by what I find in my slides. So, clause indexing comes from a particular observation out there that that a recurring theme or a recurring pattern in writing predicates is that quite often your clauses are representing some kind of case distinction based on some or particularly the first argument of your predicate. You might maybe remember the motivating example of the of appending one list to another. There also we had two clauses presented, where in the first we would assume that the first parameter is an empty list, as in the second case we would assume that the first parameter is not empty but is made up from a head and a tail. And this is such a example of a case distinction. And yeah, the idea would be for this optimization to assume that this is a recurring pattern. You would generally find a lot of cases where you would do distinction of clauses based on the first parameter, and you would just, by inspecting the first argument, you might already be able to switch to the right clause and not necessarily have to go through all of them. So this is one way of trying to get rid of this non-determinism by kind of doing a guided choice of one of the clauses here, but still, in case that you can't really say anything, you could still do the brute force on anything. So, but if you can say which of these will be actually chosen, then you save a lot of backtracking and yeah, don't build up a lot of stack frames, for example. So this is quite desirable. This is there comes the example now, where we have these case distinctions on the first parameter. So first parameter is X, and in both of these cases we match X with or unify with a certain structure, and they differ in these two cases here with each other. So in order to do the right choice of clauses here, you would then fork to the right clause based on how the first parameter looks like. So, if the root constructor of the first parameter looks like the empty set, then the first clause would be preferable. If the root constructor looks like an actual list, then the second clause is the one that is applicable. If you happen to have a completely different structure as your parameter, then you would probably directly go to fail and do backtracking. And there's just one actual real situation where you would like to explore the space of possibilities, in case that the first argument is not determined right now, is just self-reference, so non-initialized. Then of course you would have to brute force your way by trying both alternatives and just see where you land. So in order to do so, you would introduce just try chains for every possible constructor that is out there, and inspect the root node of the first argument, and dispatch via index jump to the appropriate try chain depending on the actual result of the inspection. And for that, you would introduce a macro for denoting the sequence of chains built up for the root constructors, that occur in these unification clauses for the first parameter. So you focus on this x1t and decide what different cases can there be for the structure that is found in there, and then fork to the sequence of chains here. So you can then, for our example with this list matching, our try chains would look like well, the way that you see over here, where you would introduce a case that matches whenever the variable refers to an actual real unbound variable, then you would do our standard construction that we do right now in any way, which would be this backtracking try. And in case that you get actual insight into the variable, if there's already something bound in there and it happens to be an empty list, so a nil thing, you would directly jump to the first clause. If it happens to be a constructor, then you can directly jump to the second clause, which is jump A2. Or if you find any other structure bound to this variable, you can directly go to fail, because this will not find any matching. So the fail will be just a direct call to backtrack. So for a predicate with this optimization, we can then introduce, well, first of all, of course, there's this putref for inspecting the first parameter, and then we extract the actual kind of structure that this first parameter has with a newly introduced instruction get node, and based on what this has, we do an index jump to the correct try block, and yeah, that's that. So the get node, usually what it does is what you see there. So if it inspects the heap element to which the top of the stack currently points to, and then puts a symbolic representation of whatever this thing has pointed to on top of the stack instead of the reference. So this is what this inspection thing is. This of course means that now, instead of just keeping addresses addresses on top or on the stack, we now also need the data type for stack to also be able to use these representations of things like constructors or atoms, for example. But, well, this is what you have to pay for this kind of optimization. So this, you put representations of what the references point to on top of the stack in order to switch based upon this this thing later on with this index thing. In case that there is an atom, of course, you put the A on there instead of the FN. Well, this is not given with a graphical thing, but you can imagine the same thing as in the first case. The situation for the uninitialized variable is this self-reference. This would just be symbolized with an R instead of an atom or a structure thing. So there you have your different cases. And you need to take care of the indirect jump based on this identifier for our different cases, and this is done with this index pk instruction, which would emanate from finding the representation for the actual object and looking that up in a map that is specific for that particular predicate, where we would keep the index of the case that would correspond to this identifier, and yeah, so this is kept in some kind of hash table, and with that we could then reach the different cases of implementation for our try chain, and this then would also then finally fork to the clause implementations from before. So we find the clause implementations here, and here is this small case distinction that we have introduced here. And with that you get this nice case distinction, case matching functionality as an operation in there. Ah, turns out that this is this has not been the last optimization. The actual last optimization that is out there is now the cut operator. So, what is the cut operator? This is a thing that you can apply in Prolog to the right-hand side of clauses, so to our goal collection in that sense. And this would take away backtracking from this clause from the point on where we have where we see this cut operator. So as soon as we reach the cut operator in our sequence of goals, then every backtracking point which is in the level higher than our current predicate call would be discarded, and we would, in case that we would have to backtrack, we would backtrack the one level above our current branch to the caller of that particular predicate. So this just discards backtracking points, and this is considered to be one of the main performance boosters in Prolog programming. Well, you can imagine that if you do away with these backtracking points, you can close a lot of the function frames, put them from the stack, and just continue with a much smaller stack from there on. And in case that the predicate matching beforehand already decides that this is the clause that you want to go with, then this is a perfectly fine shortcut, so to say. So, yeah. Semantically, what it does is once the queries before the cut have succeeded, we commit the choice, so backtracking will only return to points preceding the call of the current predicate, meaning the call to the left-hand side, in that sense. So we, in programming terms, we would discard all backtracking pointers that are higher than the current frame pointer. So with that, we would restore the old backtracking pointer from our current predicate frame, from our current stack frame, and can pop all the stack frames on top of the local variables, which is quite easy by just, well, they would in that sense just be overwritten. So this is automatically the case as soon as we terminate, for example, with the last pop end of this particular clause. So this cut would then be translated into a sequence of prune and push env m, which would with well, we'll see. Oh no, it doesn't do. Okay, so this is probably not so nice. So this is what it actually really does. So this prune would just restore the backtracking pointer, which can just be looked up in our current frame. So instead of something that it had been before, so before it had been pointing somewhere there possibly, but after prune is called, in our current frame, we have still the backtracking pointer from before our predicate has been called, and this is pointing to where the backtracking pointer is supposed to point after prune. So this just discards every backtracking pointer from above, and then yeah, that is that. The other one, the push env, has already been done before. So yeah, with that, we obtain for translating the example from here, where we have such a cut operator. So the branch would start with, we have two clauses, so we have backtracking with set backtracking pointer and try and delete backtracking pointer here, where A would be the corresponding thing to this P predicate. So it's not particularly interesting, it's just this for sequence that we usually have. And after we have gotten rid of the backtracking pointer, we jump to B, which should then be the this one over here. That is usually when this P is then terminated, we just fall through, so we reach this falls not through, but jumps to whatever this has been entered into the frame with this mark C. So this goes here, where it then finds prune, which then removes the backtracking pointer to one level before, and then performs the code for the last goal, which is a last call. So we will do a last mark with a last call together to do this Q1 thing. Yeah, and apart from that, the second alternative here is this jump B thing, which will then do the code over here with a push env, put ref, and jump Q. So there's no backtracking set up for this one, because this is just the last clause of all them, and it just consists of one call. So we can also reuse our current stack frame with just the move to 2 and the jump to Q2. Okay. So, you can even optimize that a little bit more, but yeah, this is probably a thing for the tutorial. So, yeah, prune we have already looked at. This just restores the old base pointer. So, yeah. What is just here? Let me just have a look. Yeah, well, there is one matter that the backtracking pointer is usually only introduced whenever we have a choice between several clauses. So, if we haven't had a clause before, then there is actually no backtrack pointer entered into the frame. This is only happening when there's several clauses and there's actual backtracking installed there. So for single clause predicates, this has to be done manually, and this is what this setCut does. So this has to be generated in front of the clause then. The setCut, all it does is it sets the field in the function frame to point to the current base pointer, so that the right one will be restored in case that we hit such a cut operator. Yeah, so this all then boils down to the final example, which implements a predicate not P that should succeed whenever a predicate P fails, and fails whenever P succeeds. So this is implemented with two clauses. Not P will, for the in the second clause, will just, well, succeed, whereas in the first clause, when it matches that the predicate P succeeds, then it commits to this branch and will fail nevertheless. So it will never never evaluate the second clause, which would lead to success. So with that, you can force your evaluation to follow into a failing branch based on particular matchings that you have done before. So this is quite a nice pattern to do. But in our case, for code generation, what does that mean? Well, we have two clauses to consider. So we introduce a set backtracking pointer together with the deletion of backtracking and try of the first part, which would be this one here. So this is found at A, where it does the call to P1, like it does here, based on the first parameter, which is just should be with overline because it's a direct parameter. This is taken from the locals, and we continue at C afterwards, where we then meet the cut operator. Thus, we prune and remove the backtracking pointer to whatever has been before, which in our environment would probably be the no or whatever negative continuation there is. And the fail will, apart from just establishing the space for the locals, just do a plain fail there, and then we will pop the current predicates frame and be done with that. So this will, in that sense, directly fail because the prune removes the backtracking at that level. In case that PX has failed before, that so has failed in there, the backtracking pointer still had been installed, so this will then instead lead to a fall through here and a direct jump to B, which is then the this second clause implementation, which is just doing nothing and in that sense succeed. So that is kind of the negation of a particular predicate in prol. Yes. Okay. And this is the last example of prol. So next time we're going to switch to a new chapter. We will have a look at garbage collection. So I think it's just appropriate to terminate that today and do a fresh topic next Tuesday. And with that, I'm done for today. Thank you for your attention and see you on Tuesday.